Committee will come to order. There's a quorum present. Clerk will note the roll. Let's see. Representative Pearson moves a minutes from March 30th, 2016. Representative Pearson has come from the watch manufacturer and has brought his minutes approved. Is there any additions, corrections, or changes? Seeing none, all those in favor of approval of the minutes, please say aye. Those opposed, no. Minutes are approved. First of all, we have up, we'll do 3248, then 3249, then we will go to 3277. And if it's okay, I will, with the rest of the group, I'm going to do these two bills from here. House File 3249, and if testifiers could please come up to the table, that would be great as well. Let's see. Welcome to the committee. House File 3249 started as a pilot project by DHS in 2007. Initial funding was from a grant to White Earth and Leech Lake. Grant has not kept up with the funding, and funding for this program has been sort of taken up, and we understand that things are getting underway, but to make this sustainable long term, we do need to make some changes. I understand that you folks are willing to testify for this. Could you please just introduce yourself for the record and just kind of give us a status situation as it is now?
My name is Lori York. I'm the director of White Earth Indian Child Welfare for White Earth Nation. And we've demonstrated our performance and our costs for the last 9 years, and the costs not covered by the American Indian Child Welfare Initiative are reflected in the request before you. White Earth has met many challenges in creating this new program by building necessary infrastructure, staffing, 4E program, code changes, etc. White Earth is proud to say that we've been through two child and family service reviews in the last 9 years, and we've outperformed our counterparts in 18 of 22 indicators. We've excelled in child safety, reducing recidivism, and relative placement rates. We've been able to change disparities on the reservation, and the state in comparison continues to increase disparities for Indian children in other jurisdictions. As White Earth continues its work in child welfare, we face budgetary constraints. The tribe has invested over $1 million per year for costs not covered by base funding without the ability to tax. We estimate that the cost savings to on-reservation reservation counties as at over $5 million annually.
Thank you. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with the testimony, ma'am.
Good afternoon. My name is Jerry Jaskin. I'm the Behavioral Health Director for the White Earth Band of Ojibwe, and I previously served as the Director of Indian Child Welfare for the past 19 years. So I'm here to be able to answer questions that you may have relating back to history of the initiative back to 2007 and how things may have changed through the years.
All right. Thank you for that. And are there questions from members for this bill? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And first of all, Mr. Chair, I'm a little confused. I just want to confirm which bill we're on. Are we on 3248?
Nine.
Okay.
They're similar, and the testifiers will be testifying to both.
Okay. I was confused because I thought you said we were going to do 8 first and then 9, and 8 is the one that pertains to child welfare. But we're on 9, which is the $1,400,000 in fiscal 2017?
That's the bill before us, Representative.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so so I guess my question is just to, can you just give us a little bit more of a sense of how that dollar amount was arrived at? Because, you know, in what we have before us, we don't have any explanation of that.
Mr. Chair, the testimony
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Haas. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Bill Haas, I represent White Earth Tribal Nation. The testimony you just heard was for the Indian Child Welfare Program, not the bill before you.
Okay.
So if you would indulge me, I can provide a little background
All right.
on that one.
We'll catch up. Sorry about that.
Okay. That's okay. I think it was our error of sending the wrong people up. Back in 2011, Representative Abel, who was chair of this committee, passed legislation that enabled White Earth and the three counties around White Earth to take the programs that were offered for welfare to tribal members, transfer all those cases to White Earth so that they would run them. In 2013, we started the implementation of that and transferring cases over to White Earth. Now, in the past, the cost of these programs and the administrative costs were put on the property tax rolls for those three counties. Because White Earth does not have the ability to levy taxes, then in our discussions with DHS, that once White Earth had a handle on all their expenses, that then we'd come forth with legislation to cover our administrative cost. And so that is the bill before you today, is the $1.4 million is our ongoing administrative cost.
And Mr. Haas, the you know, we had kind of talked a little bit about that in just in terms of ongoing. Do you feel like, how is that just in terms of budgeting, is that going to be adequate for moving forward, and how is that going to be budgeted out going forward, and how is that going to be working out?
Okay. Mr. Chair, this is will be put into the budget as a permanent budget item and put into the base of DHS.
And do you feel as though that's adequate?
Jerry, do you want to take that one?
Yes, based on current expenditures, we feel that's adequate to administer the program.
Thank you. Other questions? Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Haas, I don't fully understand all the complicated relationships between tribes and the federal government, but is the tribe able to claim the federal human services dollars that counties are able to claim through their activities, or is that another complication that we have to address or are addressing with this appropriation?
Jerry.
So we do participate in the time study for some reimbursement.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. And so that's factored into the budget before us, that a continuing federal engagement on these things. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler. Other questions? Seeing no other questions, anyone want to testify from the audience? Seeing none, all those in favor of the motion to hold over 3249, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, no. 3249 is held over. Next up, we will have 3248, and I apologize for reversing the order. When I saw you folks come up, I thought we were reversing that. So 3248, I'm going to move House File 3248 be held over. White Earth Human Services Transfer of Administration Funding. Who would like to kind of walk through the history of this one? Mr. Haas? Or?
The 3248 is the Indian Child Welfare Program, and that was the pilot project that was initiated by actually Representative Goodnow, who was the appointed commissioner of DHS back in 2006, I believe it was, and in 2007 he approached the tribes of White Earth and Leech Lake to do a pilot project for taking over the Indian child welfare cases. And so we worked with DHS, and they based the grants for our reimbursement on the current county caseload. And the problem is, once White Earth got the cases transferred, we ended up with a lot more cases than we anticipated. And thus, White Earth has been covering those costs as the program has grown, as it has expanded. And thus, we are now coming to the legislature asking for an increase in those grants on an ongoing basis, so we can keep up with our costs and continue to serve the children. The program has been very successful as far as placing children in tribal homes. They've done a good job of finding good homes with tribal members to provide a whole different environment for these out-of-home placed children, and that is critical. And that was the whole design of the program, is to try to keep the tribal children with tribal family and nurture them, be culturally specific as far as, you know, their raising, and learn their heritage and their culture from these new families.
Mr. York, could you just go through which programs White Earth administers currently?
Through the initiative?
Yeah.
Specifically? So we have a child welfare program. We handle all of the child maltreatment intakes on the reservation. We have a 24-hour intake line for maltreatment. We have assessment unit. We have a child protection unit. We have a family preservation unit. We handle Title IV-E and medical assistance. We have a family drug treatment court component and foster care program, a very large foster care program. We license of 100 Warrior tribal homes on the reservation. We have a customary adoption program and a parenting component rolled into the initiative. So we have a fairly large staff.
And for folks who might just wonder, I mean, DHS has agreed to pay the administrative portion of this because you can't levy taxes, and that's kind of the relationship. Is that correct?
That's correct.
All right. Is there other questions?
No.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you very much. I mean, it sounds pretty pretty impressive that such a big program. Just wondering, how many members does the White Earth Band have, and about how many cases? I mean, you've named an awful lot of things. I'm sure you don't have all those numbers just at the tip of your tongue, but, you know, just kind of to give us a frame of reference, you know, how many, say, intakes are you handling in a year?
Ms. York.
So to give you some statistics, we average about 800 intakes per year. So we operate at the size of a mid-sized to large county. We currently handle 194 cases, which is up from the 71 that were transferred to us in 2007. So it shows the influx of cases that we've had to deal with and gladly dealt with since taking over and assuming jurisdiction. And what was the third question?
The size of the band.
Oh, the size of the tribe, 20,000 enrolled members. And then we serve all of the children of enrolled members. That is our eligibility criteria established by the tribe. So, you know, the total number of children times 20,000 enrolled members, to answer your question. Mm-hmm. It's a very large population.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Other questions? Representative Wachler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And in our area in Minneapolis, we often have families that go back and forth from the reservation to the city and back and forth. If they were to run into issues, would that typically be handled through your child welfare activities, through a referral perhaps from Hennepin County, or is there a partnership that way? Because they really do have a foot in both communities sometimes.
Ms. York.
Yes. I would say we have very close partnerships with most of the counties within the state of Minnesota, and we have agreements, some formal, some informal, where we determine where is the residency, the official residency of the individual. So whether that is in Hennepin County or it's on the reservation, that is who the financial and active efforts responsibility goes back to. But wherever that individual is located at the time, that is the agency that deals with the issues immediately. So whether that's White Earth or the county.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Other questions?
Mr. Chair, just a comment.
Mr. Haas.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, last year in the Health and Human Services bill, there was a provision that was negotiated between the counties and the tribes called the Tribal State Agreement, and how to deal with Indian child welfare cases when they came to the county, and a whole procedural parameter set with that. And it took us about a year to negotiate that with the counties to get all of our concerns and their concerns addressed.
Other questions? Does anyone from the audience want to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, I'll renew my motion that House File 3248 be held over. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. 3248 is held over. Thank you so much for coming down for your testimony today. We do appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and committee members.
All right.
Let's do it.
Next up, we have House File 3277, Representative Zerwas. Bringing treats for his first bill before the committee. House File 3277, Representative Zerwas, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I can certainly bring treats. do have a handout.
Can I eat it?
This thing doesn't qualify.
I do have a handout that came a little bit late. A little bit late for this one, for the getting the packet, so I apologize for that. This bill is about maximizing Minnesota's SNAP employment and training program dollars and putting available federal match dollars to work for Minnesotans. The goal of the SNAP and ENT program is to help SNAP participants transition from public assistance to self-sufficiency by prepping them for and helping them attain paid employment. The USDA offers flexible reimbursement options to the state with a 50% match to help build and sustain this program. But up until this point, Minnesota has underutilized this option. We are missing out on significant federal funds, and the little we are currently getting is being sent back to the general fund rather than being used for its intended purpose, to help SNAP, participants get the skills training they need to get good employment. This bill aims to remedy this and get Minnesota on track to receive our allotted amount of federal dollars and put those dollars to work for Minnesotans who need them most. I have several testifiers here today who can speak about the bill in greater detail, and the handout is also being passed around. With that, Mr. Chair, I'll turn it over to my testifiers.
Thank you, Representative Zerwas. House File 3277 is before us to be laid over. And to the testifiers, please introduce yourself in whatever order you'd like and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Brian Lindsley, and I am the Executive Director of MSP WIN, a philanthropic collaborative comprised of 14 workforce program funders. As funders, we have a keen interest in ensuring Minnesota's SNAP ENT program is robust and effective. Currently, we have a disconnect in our economy. Minnesota employers increasingly report a shortage of skilled workers, while increased skill requirements leave many potential workers unable to secure the training they need to compete for jobs and in need in public subsidies to meet their basic needs. The SNAP ENT program serves some of our lowest skilled workers and is thus well positioned to help shrink the skills gap. The USDA provides a very flexible, uncapped reimbursement program for states to get a 50% of their training investments back. This reimbursement is a significant opportunity to build a robust and effective SNAP ENT program because it can be applied to, quote, third-party dollars spent on training and supports for SNAP participants, meaning the state will not have to spend new money to draw down more federal dollars. These training investments are already being made across the state by counties, colleges, community organizations, foundations, and others. But Minnesota is not taking full advantage of these federal dollars that could help benefit job seekers and employers alike. House File 3277 is a first step towards doing that. The bill instructs DHS to work to capture Minnesota's fair share of additional 50-50 reimbursement dollars and ensures that the money will go back to the organizations that incurred the training costs so it can be reinvested in skills training for SNAP participants. It also cancels a scheduled transfer of $4.4 million in current reimbursement dollars to the general fund and requires that these funds be used for their intended purpose, to supplement Minnesota's investments in education and training for SNAP participants. Sending this money to the general fund does not help participants or the local partners working hard to serve them. The goal of the ENT program is to help SNAP participants transition from public assistance to self-sufficiency by preparing them for and helping them obtain paid employment. These reimbursement dollars are needed if we are to make progress towards that goal. If you take a look at the handout in your packets, you'll see that there's a chart on the front that shows how Minnesota compares to three other states as far as 50-50 funding based on their 2015 state plans. Wisconsin was authorized to receive over $21 million in reimbursement, while Minnesota was only receiving $5.5 million. These three states are also reinvesting all of their reimbursement dollars back into SNAP ENT programs, but Minnesota is not. There's no doubt that there's room for improvement in our program, and we believe that passing this bill is a step in the right direction. We hope you will support this bill so we can make progress towards building a strong, job-driven SNAP employment and training program. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lindsley. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Jim Dirtle, and I am the Workforce Development Associate Director with Goodwill Easter Seals, Minnesota. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it's my honor to speak with you today about my experience running the SNAP Employment and Training Program over the last 5 years with the Heading Home Employment Collaborative. Our group started as one of the Heading Home committees in Hennepin and Ramsey County, and together we developed employment as a strategy to end homelessness. SNAP Employment and Training Program is key to this work. Heading Home employment providers include several community-based nonprofits, Goodwill Easter Seals, Catholic Charities, Project for Pride and Living, and YouthLink. Our team works to provide job search assistance, occupational skills training and work experience, and support services, exactly the kind of services reimbursable under SNAP employment and training. Staff are co-located, sharing common space, resulting in a streamlined process, and job seekers can access individualized employment services in one place, leveraging the expertise and resources of our collective organizations. SNAP employment and training provide this kind of flexibility in program design. Together, our work is addressing racial disparities, and we work through complex barriers to employment. 69% of those served are people of color, and challenges individuals face, 40% have been unemployed for 6 months or longer, 46% have a criminal record, and again, 100% of those we serve are experiencing homelessness. Our outcomes at Goodwill Easter Seals alone over the last 3 years include 188 individuals gaining employment, moving from no income to an average wage of $10.60 per hour, working 35 hours per week, supporting a path to housing. We see several opportunities for SNAP employment and training in Minnesota. Its effectiveness in reaching underserved populations, meeting the unique needs of various communities by developing collaborations, achieving results by integrating systems, employment and housing, employment and education. Finally, there are great opportunities to bring services to scale by drawing down these federal funds. Minnesota has many strong employment programs. The challenge is often getting them to scale to match the need in our community. SNAP employment and training can be part of this solution. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Thank you, Mr. Durdell. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, I'm Louis King, President and CEO of Summit Academy, OIC, an accredited vocational training school located in North Minneapolis. We believe that the best social service program in the world is a job. Thank you for having us before you today, and we are excited about the potential opportunity to become a part of the SNAP ENT family. We currently enroll approximately 800 people a year in the school. The average wage coming in is $3,000. 70% have been unemployed prior to joining us. In 20 weeks without any loans, and even if they are not eligible for financial aid, we can get them jobs averaging $16 to $22 an hour in the construction trades. And we're pushing really hard for higher wages in health care. We work with people who made mistakes when they were 16 and 17 years of age. They're now in their mid-20s with families. Prior to taking this job, I was an Army officer for 10 years pushing troops. And I learned being a disciplinarian that you could kick them all out and punish them, or you could make something out of them. We give people the opportunity to make up for mistakes that they made when they were 16 years old. All of us were 16 at some point. But when you don't get a good education and you don't get good skills, it's the gift that keeps on giving. And trying to get the resources to put these people to work is very tough. 60% of the people who come through our doors actually make it. The other 40%, for the most part, are unstable in their living conditions and in situations beyond our grasp. So support service dollars are very important. We can bring those numbers up. We intend to increase our enrollment to 1,200 by also taking on the GED challenge. We will be a very good partner here. I raise a lot of private money, bringing it to the table to help the state in this endeavor. A very solid investment in our people. And finally, we consider this. In the 90s, our workforce grew by 47,000 people a year. By the year 2020, that growth rate will go down to zero. We have, and 100% of our growth, when it does come back, will be from people of color. We have to bring these people off the island and off the sideline into the economic mainstream. And SNAP ENT is a vehicle where we can leverage federal dollars to keep our economy strong, grow our businesses, and maintain our quality of life. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there any other, do you have any other testifiers?
Mr. Chair, I don't have any other testifiers.
Is there any audience members that would like to speak to the bill? Any final comments, Representative? Any member questions, excuse me, I'm sorry. Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I definitely support us using federal partnerships wherever we can, and I think that's an important part of this bill, and it seems like our state can do a lot to expand our efforts on this effort. The part that I had a question about is on page 3, where you actually, in addition to authorizing all these programs to get the 50% federal participation and to hang on to it, you're also eliminating the reimbursement of our MFIP Consolidated Fund grant expenditures. That's the fund that supports our lowest income families, those families that are getting less than $550 a month, have 60 months, where some of the people you've described don't have that time limit on them. They have 60 months to over their lifetime to develop the kind of skills you're talking about and be able to not only support themselves like a homeless gentleman might, but also their children. And so I don't really want to jeopardize the MFIP Consolidated Fund and its support for families while still expanding your ability to draw down 50% federal money for anyone who's on food stamps, no matter what their age or sex or family situation. And so I'm wondering if you or someone from your coalition or DHS could tell us about the impact of this on the MFIP Fund for families, because I really do think those funds should be targeted for those families. It's hard to support one person on current wage levels for people without good educations, as you know, let alone support a family.
Mr. Chair, members of Representative Loeffler, I think we have someone from, I think we have a familiar face.
Yes.
That can
always
help answer that question.
Mr. Hosh, clarify things.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, this doesn't
even your name for the record.
Oh, I'm sorry, Larry Hosh with the Minnesota Department of Human Services. This doesn't eliminate consolidated fund expenditures. What we currently do, we can use the consolidated fund expenditures to qualify for that 50% SNAP match. And what this rider language is just requiring that this reimbursement be put into the general fund. This will just redirect it towards employment and training services.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's just the way it's worded. It says reimbursement of MFIP Consolidated Fund grant expenditures, and so it seems like it should go back into the MFIP Consolidated Fund, not into, you know, other uses. But perhaps Mr. Berg will follow up with that, because I do think we just need to make sure that we're not diverting funds that could be allocated to that particular group while continuing to expand the bubble. And anything to add to that, Mr. Berg?
Mr. Berg, sure.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Loeffler, the language you're looking at is the language that actually does divert the money and puts it in the general fund. as Mr. Hosh was saying, what this language does is it says we can count 4.4 million of MFIP expenditures to receive the federal match. And then if you look at lines 3.16 through 3.20, in four fiscal years, it then diverts that 4.4 million in reimbursement money to the general fund. Mm-hmm. So eliminating this means that the diversion doesn't occur in fiscal 17 and that the fund actually receives the reimbursement.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Any final comments, Representative Zerwas?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members. With that, I will renew my motion.
All right. Then House File 3277 will be laid over for possible inclusions. Representative Zerwas, I believe you have another bill. Would you like to move the bill?
Yes. I will move that House File 978 be referred to Ways and Means.
Representative Zerwas, to your bill.
Mr. Chair, members, this is another bill out of the Healthcare Subcommittee on Licensure. This deals with the licensure of genetic counselors. There is one amendment that came after the deadline, and I think talks a little bit to that. That will look at it, Ways and Means, and I think Mr. Burke can explain. If you can explain.
Wait, Representative Zerwas, those are being copied right now, I understand, so they're not before our committee members, so we will get those out.
Come back to that, Mr. Chair.
That's all right.
Mr. Burke is on deck and ready, and we'll come back to that. At this point, I'll just briefly turn it over to our testifier, and then we can do the HHS finance impact with that fiscal note and that amendment at the back end.
Thank you, Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Joy Larson-Hidley. I'm a genetic counselor working in clinical cancer genetics from Maple Grove. I work up at the Humphrey Cancer Center in Robbinsdale. I'm also the immediate past president for the National Society of Genetic Counselors and a clinical instructor for the University of Minnesota's Graduate Training Program in Genetic Counseling. So thank you for the opportunity to testify in favor of House File 978, as this is important legislation that would provide licensure for certified genetic counselors in Minnesota. Genetic counselors are employed in a wide variety of academic and clinical care, laboratory, and research settings. And within Minnesota, there's over 100 genetic counselors, most of whom are providing direct patient care in a variety of subspecialties. The availability of genetic and genomic testing services is growing rapidly. There's approximately 10 new genetic and genomic tests that come to the market every day. Not only are there more tests, the complexity of those tests are changing pretty rapidly. Licensure of counselors in Minnesota is consistent with the 21 other states that have already enacted laws, and the states in our region are North Dakota, South Dakota, Illinois, Indiana, Ohio, and Nebraska. House File 978 is extremely important bill that would help protect the public from potential harms that may result from this occupation remaining unregulated. In addition, genetic counselors, I wanted to talk briefly about the financial impact of this bill. In reference to this situation, the initial application for the genetic counselor license is $200 with an annual renewal fee of $150. In our conversations with the Board of Medical Practice, these fees will cover the cost. Therefore, the bill has no general fund impact. So in summary, genomics is changing rapidly, and genetic counselors are key players in appropriately and effectively integrating genomic applications into healthcare. Clinicians and patients need to know that the genetic counselors that they work with and see are adequately trained and up-to-date on genomic information. Both NSGC and MNGCA urge you to enact the legislation as it would establish the minimum requirements for licensure genetic counselors and the minimum academic achievement, clinical experience, and skills necessary to deliver these high-quality services. So currently in Minnesota, there's no legal standard for who can represent themselves as a genetic counselor, and as the field of medical genetics grows, there is and will continue to be a need for the citizens of Minnesota to be provided with accurate information in this regard. Both NSGC and MNGCA thank the chair and the committee members for your attention to this important issue, and we offer ourselves to be resources. Thank you.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Zerwas, and to you and to your witness. I am hoping that you can help me and the committee understand how creating licensure for genetic counselors fits into the scheme of those providers caring for people with genetic conditions. So where does the scope of the practice of the newly licensed genetic counselor meet and overlap with other providers doing that same work? And would providers currently doing the work who would not be licensed as a counselor somehow be fenced out from the work that they're currently doing?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So thank you for that question. Right now, the scope for a genetic counselor is the main job that we're doing is we're collecting family histories and personal medical histories, doing a risk assessment, interpreting what that information means for the health of that person and for their family. We talk through what kinds of testing options might be available, how those people might use that information in their medical care, and we'll review the literature and talk about the kinds of health complications that might go along with the condition, what can be done to help maximize, for example, if it's a child with learning differences, their potential, as far as what else can be done to help reduce the risk. Like, I work in cancer, so what could we do to help reduce that chance of developing cancer over a lifetime? My main job is I work in collaboration with our healthcare providers, so with our MDs. So it's my job to review that literature because many of these conditions we're working with are pretty rare and our colleagues may not have had any experience with those conditions. So we do work hand in hand with those physicians. We'll educate them on what this condition is, but that's where our scope stops. We hand that information over to the physician. It's up to them at that point to go ahead and make the determination of how should I take care of that person in the best way. But we help our skill sets work in parallel to help support each other in providing that best care.
And I do believe the A4 is in front of everyone. If Mr. Berg would like to bring that up, won't be offered today, but it's for discussion.
Mr. Chair, members, the A4 amendment simply appropriates $22,000 in fiscal 2017 from the state government special revenue fund to the Board of Medical Practice to implement this. As was mentioned in testimony, the $22,000 appropriation is offset by revenue that it raises, and since it's in the second year of the biennium and is not specified to be one time, it'll be added to the base of the medical practice board.
Mr. Chair.
Representatives or less?
Members, I just wanted to make sure. Unfortunately, I forwarded the email a few hours too late, and so it didn't meet the 24-hour deadline. And so we'll address this at ways and means. But being this is the Finance Committee, I just wanted to make sure everyone saw this fiscal note as this bill works its way through the process.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so Representative Zerwas and your testifier. So kind of following on Representative Murphy's question a little bit, you know, under Section 214, which is the statute that sort of sets out the rules around occupational licensing and health care, I don't have it in front of me, but it basically says that you should use the least restrictive form of regulation that meets the need for safety. And so I just wanted to ask you, so this is a bill, you mentioned in your testimony that genetic counselors currently are not regulated in Minnesota, and yet the bill is going all the way to licensing, which is the most restrictive kind. So I just wanted to ask you, could you explain to the committee, why is it not adequate to do some kind of registration or certification that, in fact, wouldn't fence anybody out, whereas licensing by its very nature does fence people out?
Ms. Hadle?
Mr. Chair. So as a genetic counselor, we will have graduated from a two-year master's degree program that is it's a very specific high-level training for medical genetics as well as the counseling and the technology that goes with that.
at the conclusion of that, we sit for a board exam through American Board of Genetic Counseling. That's a really rigorous exam, but it's also an academic achievement. So for me to take and pass that, and then after that I'm maintaining continuing education units, there isn't a way to revoke my board certification. So if I'm not doing my job well, and I'm not staying current, and I'm not providing safe and appropriate care, or if I have, for example, substance abuse issues, there is nothing that the state of Minnesota or the citizens could come back and file any kind of concern.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Zerwas.
I think the other concern of what we've talked about in some of the other committees is we look at the potential for harm. And in this instance, we know multiple instances from documented research from within the state of Minnesota where practitioners have provided inappropriate advice and inappropriate care directives that have resulted in care that's sometimes unnecessary and sometimes inappropriate. And there is no fallback after that. And so, Mr. Chair and members, when we're talking about the practice of genetic counseling, we're talking about practitioners that are giving medical recommendations to a physician team that can be anywhere from, you have the type of breast cancer that if in one breast will likely be in the other. And so a potential recommended course of action is a radical double mastectomy. That could be the advice from here. It could also be, here's the potential genetic abnormality of a child in utero. And here are potential lifelong implications of that. And not just putting that out there, but here's what's being done now. And here's current treatments, and here's other options to try to give someone that has to make such an unbelievably difficult medical decision about the course of treatment they're taking for cancer treatment or how they're going to care for their child, to make sure that they have absolutely every bit of current, accurate, medically valid data. That's what we're putting on to these positions. With those types of ramifications, I do not believe it's out of bounds to look at the step of licensure, especially as we see coming onto the market mail order genetics tests, where you can Google a genetics test and have something mailed, and you send off your blood, and you get a report that says you might have this, you might have that. That's inappropriate. And that's bad health care for Minnesotans. And we ought to direct Minnesotans to safe, responsible health care in the use of this genetic information.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Representative Zerwas, I don't disagree with you about that there's potential for harm. I mean, we discussed this in the last committee, and, you know, I hear you on that. But I don't know that, you know, the potential for harm here, the question isn't just, could there be harm, right? The question is, can you deal with that harm through a lesser regulation? Like, for example, registration. So you have another bill that's about registration.
Mm-hmm.
So it isn't entirely clear to me what licensure gives you that registration wouldn't give you in this case in terms of safety. And then what you just brought up as an example, this mail order stuff. So if this bill becomes law, is that, you know, when somebody, that mail order stuff is not going to stop. Does this bill, what does this bill do to those people who over the internet are going to give people advice about their, you know, if a lot of people do this for genealogy, right? And so they get quote-unquote genetic testing that's going to tell them where their ancestors came from or something like that. I mean, will this bill impact that? I mean, so what's the effect of licensure on all of that stuff?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Zerwas.
It would not impact that. It would impact anyone that tried without licensure to portray themselves as a licensed genetic counselor.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Representative Liebling.
And, okay, he's getting a little advice here first. Okay.
Sorry.
Maybe, I don't know, Representative Zerwas, it's got to be, it's more than that, because registration, you know, if they had registration, no one could portray themselves as a registered genetic counselor. But that's a little different, because then someone who, say, wants to give advice in a certain prescribed area could maybe do it without holding themselves out as a registered genetic counselor. And I'm sure that no cancer center would hire one of those people. So why do we actually have to fence out anyone who might want to do any of this and not go through this high-level licensing procedure?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Representative Leland, this licensure bill, like all others, if you have folks that are providing unsound advice or not technical practice within their scope, or are acting inappropriately, or have a chemical dependency issue, or have a multitude of other issues, what licensure provides is the finality and ability of revocation of licensure. And when we're talking about a healthcare protocol and recommendations that are truly as life-changing and life-altering as the types of medical decisions that are being based off the recommendations of genetic counselors, I don't think it's outside of the realm that if you have someone that is not doing their job appropriately and is outside of their bounds or not within their scope, and they're making those types of recommendations inappropriately, that revocation of licensure would be an appropriate remedy, like in our other licensure areas.
Okay. Members, are there any other questions? Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify on the bill? Any final comments, Representative Zerwas?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members. I'll renew my motion to refer the bill to Ways and Means.
All those in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed say no. Motion carries.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members.
With that, this meeting is adjourned.